Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland. Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Yeah, I that has practically no connection whatsoever to what we're going to talk about, but people think it does.
Okay.
Because Hal, H-A-L, that's one letter off from
IBM.
Yep. Yep. So this is part two of our episode about the history of IBM and its impact on technology, which I think it's safe to say it cannot be understated.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. It can't be overstated. That's where you're supposed to jump on me for using the wrong word.
Oh, okay. Well, it's funny. We didn't talk about it at all, and I'm just going to throw this in as a footnote before we get started.
Sure.
We didn't talk about it in the first episode. One of the reasons that we've got three episodes on IBM is because the company's been around for a very long time, has done a lot of technological innovation, has a very rich company culture, which includes music.
Yes.
In fact, is one of the few companies that has its own anthem.
Yes.
You know, in fact, Thomas J. Watson Sr., who became, we're starting this episode in 1952, he became IBM president in 1952, officially, although he led the company before that. He established the first company band in 1915. So all along, the entire company hit, well, not the entire company history, but a lot of the company history for almost 100 years now. They've had a company band. They have a company anthem.
It's they weird even have they play all their music on tabulating machines. It's very rhythmic, but not melodic.
The IBM songbook was printed the year after we're starting this in 1953. Songbook. You can listen to this at the archives at IBM.com. So if you want to hear the IBM anthem, the IBM fight song, there is one.
It's, oh no!
Well, it's a rally song. It's called "Ever Onward," and
I'm just wondering, down with you, Apple, down with you.
Not then. It wasn't because Apple wasn't established until the
1970s. Yes, I know.
So yeah. It would actually be more like down with you, Burroughs.
Right.
We should do Burroughs. That would be kind of fun.
I guess so.
Sometime after we get done with
a given definition of the word fun, yes.
Well, just because they were a computer innovator.
Yes, this is true.
But we decided to start again with IBM in 1952. Again, Watson Jr. became the company president in 1952.
Yeah.
His dad was leading the company before that. I misspoke earlier.
And Watson Sr. was a chairman of the board by 19.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. No.
What about Sinatra?
Oh, well, no. He was over there with Dino and where am I going with this? Ain't that a kick in the head? I was listening to that this morning.
So you wanted to talk about the 701.
Did I? Yes. Yes,
I did. The first production computer.
Yes. So 1952, IBM introduces the 701, starting a long line of catchy IBM product names.
Well, let's face it, okay? We're talking about a kind of industry that just isn't sexy in terms of consumers.
Right, right.
People weren't buying computers for their homes.
The customers here were businesses.
So why do you need a fancy name?
Yeah, you just need something that's easy to look up. You don't need something that's, you know, you don't need the Jaguar.
Well, hey, if you're going to get right down to it,
it
still works for Peugeot, which sells cars with three-digit names with a zero in the middle. So,
and then you're like,
702 would be right up there, Alan.
So the 701 comes out in 1952. It is the first IBM large scale electronic computer manufactured in mass quantities. It was the first commercially available scientific computer, and it had a program stored in an internal addressable electronic memory, which was brand new for the time.
Yep.
And that's something that we all take for granted now because we've had it for decades, but this was a brand new idea, and it only took 2 years from the time when IBM first sketched out the idea for the 701 to when it rolled off the production lines. So 2 year development cycle for a brand new groundbreaking computer is phenomenal. That shows that IBM was really putting some of their smartest, hardest working engineers on this project.
And it seems like they'd taken the IBM motto that you spoke of in the last podcast about Thomas J. Watson Sr. Think very much to heart.
Yes.
It was only a year later that they came out with a 702, which was a commercial version of the computer, and the 650 magnetic drum calculator, which apparently calculated drums.
Yeah. And wait a minute. No, it didn't.
No.
So anyway, the reason for one of the reasons, I should say, for the rapid development of the 701 and the 702 was actually the outbreak of another conflict. It was the Korean War, which broke out in June of 1950. And Thomas J. Watson Sr. asked the U.S. government what IBM could do to help the war effort. And the government said, build us some really powerful scientific computers that we can use for our, you know, for our strategic needs. And that was what got IBM to work. And the 701 and 702 are kind of direct results of that discussion. It's kind of an interesting story in the idea that Watson at this point is, he's like, look, I have this huge corporation. We have all power of mind here. We've got some of the finest engineers in all the world working for my company. What can I do to help? I mean, that's kind of phenomenal. It's not just, hey, you know what would make us a lot of money? Let's do this. I think that's a pretty interesting, you know, it shows a certain philosophy that Watson had that I thought was pretty interesting.
Also kind of interesting to note, just on a corporate culture side, in 1953, that's when Thomas J. Watson Jr. Wrote the first equal opportunity policy letter for the company.
Which came a full year before Brown versus the Board of Education.
Right.
So before the Supreme Court had even heard that case, Watson Jr. was saying that, you know, he was establishing that there should be an equal opportunity employment culture at IBM. So again, we're starting to see that IBM's not just leading the way technology-wise, they're leading the way as far as corporate culture goes.
Yes.
They are pioneers in multiple avenues, which is kind of interesting. So, you know what they did in 1954? You know what military computer they developed then?
No, what?
The Naval Ordnance Research Computer, or
NORC.
Yeah, fastest electronic computer at that time. So Again, IBM working with the United States government on that.
Yeah, they succeeded the 701 with the 704 and mm-hmm. the 702 with the 705,
mm-hmm.
And introduced new typewriters as well.
Yep.
Including the executive typewriter. Except
yes.
I didn't think executives typed back in those days. I think they had somebody to do that for them.
Yeah, the executive assistant typewriter is really what it should have been called.
Probably so.
1955, IBM develops magnetic core storage units. So that research they had been doing a couple years previously was starting to pay off. 1956 was a big year for IBM for a sad reason.
Yes.
Because that was when Thomas J. Watson Sr. died.
Yes.
He passed away in 1956. So at the time that Watson Sr. passed away, if you remember from our previous podcast on IBM, we talked about when Watson took control, the gross income was $4 million and the net earnings was $1 million.
Yeah.
Let's compare that to when he passed away in 1956. At that time, IBM's gross income was $892 million. The earnings was $87 million, and they employed 72,504 employees.
Even adjusted for inflation, that's a significant increase.
And, you know, when Watson took control, there were, 1,600 employees.
Right.
Now 72,504 by the time he passes away.
Also, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say also, as their innovation has gone on, they've increased not only the ability for machines to process information, increase the speed with which it's processing information, but they're also moving gradually from electromechanical devices to electronic devices.
Yes, by the time you're hitting the 701, 702, and 704, and 705 machines, you're really moving away from the punch card era. They're starting to be able to phase out punch cards to some extent. Now, punch cards would remain an important part of IBM for years to come, just because, you know, just as IBM is developing this new technology, that doesn't mean that all the companies that are IBM's customers can adopt that technology immediately. So IBM continued to support that older technology for years, although it was also driving the innovation that made it possible to move away from the old punch card system.
Yeah, before anyone writes in to say this, unless, of course, you've paused the podcast, in which case you're violating rule number 7 of the podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, we're aware that people were still programming with punch cards into the 70s and possibly 80s. I wouldn't be surprised if there's not somebody doing it now because they're on some legacy system
that
requires you to use this, you know, some antiquated programming language. So they're moving away from it, but they haven't completely abolished
like I said,
it.
They support it, but they don't. That's not where the innovation is. And also, by the way, rule number 6 of the podcast is there is no rule number 6 of the podcast, in case you guys are keeping track. So 1957, that's when they developed the 709 computer. That's also, do you know what language came out in that year? Programming language developed by IBM?
Fortran.
Yes, Fortran. This is, again, a big, big step. IBM makes Fortran programming language available to consumers. Before that, you know, you didn't really have access to a way of programming your computer. It pretty much ran on whatever protocols you happened to have. Fortran, now you can develop your own. Not easy. Fortran was not necessarily something you could just quickly pick up in an afternoon, but it still was a big leap as far as computers are concerned.
Yeah, it's not Python. Let's just say that.
No. Do you have anything between 57 and 61? Because my next thing that I want to really talk about comes in 61.
Yes. Well, I have another giggle moment.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you listen to the last podcast, I was giggling because originally when IBM was founded, it was as a merger between three companies making equipment for businesses.
Right.
One of which was a scale company. One of which was a tabulating machine company, uh-huh. which is essentially the computer part. And then the other was a time recording company.
Yes.
Now, of course, you know, clocks, very important to computers, but they decided at an earlier point to get rid of the scale company because it just wasn't doing what they thought it would.
Right.
So Mr. Watson Sr. decided to get rid of it, and it immediately took off and is now part of a very large company that still sells things, so it did not fail.
Yes.
Neither did the time equipment division when they decided to sell it to Simplex Time Recorder Company, which is now Simplex Grinnell. So
yeah,
they are dividing themselves up. We didn't mention that. Just as a note, As the company is moving on, especially now in the 1950s, the company is splitting off divisions.
Yes.
They now have a military division even to help develop products for the military, as well as, you know, different kinds of businesses. So apparently they decided to divest themselves of this one, which continued to succeed without them.
But you know what?
I don't fault them
for that.
I think it
it still shows wisdom, though, right? Because,
Because
there is the possibility that let's say you are running an enormous corporation, and you have a lot of balls to juggle, right? You got a lot of irons in the fire, if you prefer that metaphor. So you got all these irons in the fire, and you may not be able to push all of them the way they need to be in order to succeed. There's nothing wrong with that. And selling something off that you cannot make succeed and then seeing it succeed, all that means is that the potential was there. You just didn't have the resources necessary to make it happen.
That's true. It could have done poorly since it's not a core business for IBM at this point.
Right.
It may actually have been a drag on IBM.
Yes.
And IBM may not have been able to put the resources behind it that it would take to make it successful. So it's just sort of a, it turns out that wasn't
it wasn't anything inherently bad about the division itself. Well, I personally consider that a success for everybody involved.
True.
Because the alternative was that IBM could have held on to it and then could have suffered for it, both the division and IBM itself.
Sure. IBM put all its workers on salary and introduced a stock purchase plan in 1958, which was, again, showing a lot of foresight
and
treating its employees well.
Corporate culture pioneers.
The 7000 series computers were introduced in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So the vacuum tube machines, the 700 series,
yes,
now obsolete.
So yeah, vacuum tubes, that, if you guys aren't familiar, I mean, that was the precursor to the transistor. So you've got vacuum tubes, which were very efficient, comparatively speaking, but they had other problems. Like, for one, they generated a lot of heat and they took up a lot of space. So when we're talking about computers with IBM, we're talking mainframe computers. The early mainframe computers were so large they could take up an entire room in a building. And in fact, some of the supercomputers of the day would take up an entire floor of a building. And because we're talking about vacuum tubes, that's part of the reason why they were so big. It wasn't that they were super, super powerful, although they were for their time. It was because the individual components that made up the supercomputer were much larger than the ones we have in our devices today.
Sure, sure.
So it would get pretty warm and steamy in the supercomputer room with all those vacuum tubes going.
Yep.
And it wasn't until IBM really started to dedicate itself to solid-state electronics, when we're talking about solid-state transistors, that we started to see a shift away from vacuum tubes and toward alternative means of processing.
Yep. Now, just quickly, in 1960, you could tell that even back in Herman Hollerith's day, Hollerith was the person who created the tabulating portion of the original companies that formed IBM. They're still doing the same kind of work. The 305 RAMAC machine was used to score the Winter Olympic Games that year, and California was used at political conventions to tally votes.
They gave Sweden a 9.4.
And processing for presidential election returns.
Mm-hmm.
IBM was used to launch and track Project Echo, which was a space communications experiment.
You said
the
United
that wrong. Did.
It's Project Echo.
And they were using the Mark II language translator to translate Russian into English.
Yeah, that here's something else that I did not know until I started researching this podcast.
Yeah.
IBM has pioneered some technologies that we're just starting to see benefit us today, but they started it decades ago.
Yes.
You sit there and you think, like, there's no way in the early 60s that could have possibly been there. And yet you find out, wait a minute, they were working on this. We're just now starting to see things like Google's Translate software or their applications where you can translate languages on the fly. That stuff, it has its history way back in these days of development in IBM. So 1961, this is the one that I wanted to talk about. And Chris, I know you want to talk about it too, because you just showed me a picture of it.
I think he's actually salivating, ladies and gentlemen.
It's the Selectric typewriter.
Yes, yes.
So what was different about the Selectric than, say, older typewriters?
Well, I can be honest with you here. I know this stuff straight away. My mom had a Selectric typewriter.
Did my dad.
Which is still in the family, I believe. I actually have an Underwood typewriter. Now, those typewriters, these are the old typewriters, yes, which weigh about 7 tons.
Yeah, they're heavy.
But they also, well, you know, they're very robust, but they used to have keys, and each of the keys, and I'm not talking about the keyboard keys, each of the keyboard keys was linked to a key with one letter on it.
Yes.
So, and they were all arranged in an arc.
Yeah.
Facing the paper. So as you pressed one key, that little arm would reach up and type that letter on the paper.
Yeah, so each letter had its own dedicated arm. And this is all mechanical, right? This is all connected through a series of levers and little pistons that you press the D button, and the D bar goes forward and stamps the paper with the D letter on the end. There's actually a ribbon there that has the ink. The key, the head of it, the arm hits the ink, and that prints the letter onto the paper.
And when you got to the end of that, and this is a mechanical typewriter, no electricity needed to make this work. When you get to the end of the line, you need to make a carriage return to the next line, a la Jerry Lewis. You press the
ding,
and you hit the ding. You have to press the lever back, and it advances you to the next line. Well, the Selectric was an electric typewriter.
Well, and electric typewriters had been out for a few decades, but this was a new design.
Yes. Which, instead of using those little arms, used a ball with all the outdented letters on it.
Yeah, arranged around
the right thing.
Also, I'm not sure.
You
projected.
Yes. The other cool thing about that. Well, so when you type a key, the typewriter knows which where on the ball that letter is, and will rotate the ball and angle it so that it will type that letter in a precise alignment with the rest of the letters on the page.
Right.
That's one thing that makes it cool. Another thing that makes it cool is you could change the ball.
Yes.
So no longer are you limited to typewriter font. You can change the size and the typeface.
Yes.
Because it's a font when it's not on the paper, and when it is, it's a typeface.
I did not know that.
Yes. So you could remove these and change it out if you wanted to. Now, this benefited people like my mom, who, this will astonish you, could type 135 words a minute.
Wow.
When she used the older style typewriters, the keys would jam and rub against one another so often that she would have to have her typewriter replaced.
Also,
because it would just completely destroy the typewriter.
Since it required physical force, you had to actually type a little harder, especially on older typewriters. I know this from experience too, because I've used one of those. That if you were typing on an old typewriter, you couldn't go as fast because you had to use more force per stroke. Especially if you're typing lightly, the arm might not strike the paper hard enough to make a good impression, and then you've got this kind of faded look, even though you've just typed it, right?
Right,
it's almost looks like you're running out of ink, but really it just means you're running out of steam. So yeah, the Selectric was pretty cool. It looks like, if you've ever seen one, you would recognize it immediately. It looks like a little golf ball.
Yeah.
Is the typing interface there. And, yeah, you're 130, huh?
Yeah.
My top speed was 105.
My mom, when she got going, sounded like a machine gun.
Yeah.
Because it was moving so fast.
That explains why you duck around corners a lot do those weird hand signals whenever you want to go down the hallway.
Yeah. Best I can get is around 60. So I'm still, that still blows me away. But, this was also the period in time when, IBM, they were still working on the space program.
Yes.
They created a guidance computer for the Saturn series.
Yes. And also the Gemini, or if you prefer, Gemini. I cannot stand that pronunciation.
Which of the astronauts. We did this so long ago.
We did the Gemini podcast.
Yeah, it was one of the Gemini astronauts that said it that way.
I don't know. That just makes me think of Eddie Carroll. He was the voice for Jiminy Cricket. Yeah. Friend of the family. Anyway, so they developed the guidance computers for the space program for both the Saturn and Gemini. well, I figure might as well, right?
Just keep going with
Saturn
it.
And Gemini programs. And so that's kind of cool. You know, IBM was this was one of those things where IBM had to submit a proposal to the government, and they were selected to develop these guidance computer systems.
It's Selectric.
Yeah. In 1964, IBM announced the next really, really big development. One of the most important developments in the company's history. You could argue it is the most important at this point.
A bread slicer?
No. The System Stroke 360.
The controversial system Stroke 360.
Was it controversial?
It was controversial.
Pray elaborate, Mr. Paulette.
Well, in doing research on IBM, I can tell you right now that there is a lot of information on IBM.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know everything there is to know about the System Stroke 360. Mm-hmm. There is actually, if you want to go and really want to know more about the system, I would suggest going to the Computer History Museum, computerhistory.org.
Yes.
They actually have a seminar on the System Stroke 360.
Wow.
But in a nutshell, it was a mainframe computer, and it was a huge gamble. Because it was the system that they came up with was so dramatically different. It required a massive investment. And they were not 100% certain that it was going to work. As in, they weren't certain that people would adopt this kind of system. So with the amount of money that they poured into the program, in
which
a nutshell.
Billions of dollars, as I recall.
A whole lot of R&D money they poured into this. As a matter of fact, $5 billion.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
According to the article that I read in Wired magazine or online. They decided to create the system. But what made it so different was, you know, we were just talking about how large these mainframe computers were. They could take up massive amounts of floor space in your business. Well, this was a modular system.
Right.
Modular. It could have you might have the CPU in one device and a display terminal that goes with it and a control unit and data cell storage and drum storage.
So if you needed more computing power, you purchase more modules.
Right. The card punch unit, that's a separate device.
Yep. Still had card punch.
And if you think about it, that's pretty much the way we're doing things now.
Yeah.
On a different scale. But I mean, again, this is before there are a lot of people using computers in, you know, personally on their desktop at work. But I mean, now at this point you have your server and you have, you know, when somebody comes into your company, they get their own computer and in some cases printer and, you know, whatever else they happen to need.
Sometimes a monitor if they want to see what's going on.
External hard drive. You have your server. If you need more server space, you add another disk drive to the server.
Yep.
So the modular model
it was a big gamble, but it ended up being the right one. Also, there was another big gamble that they introduced with the System Stroke 360, which was that they introduced the 8-bit byte. Before that, they really pushed the 8-bit byte. It wasn't the first time that had ever been around, but that's what this system used. Now, there were other computers that used 12-bit and 36-bit based computers. So they were around, but because IBM pushed this, because it got adopted, because the gamble paid off, the 8-bit byte became standard. And just think, if without this system, we might have a lot more confusion in the marketplace. But so each computer, do you happen to know how much they cost when they started to sell them?
Oh, well, according to Wired, in 1966, IBM was selling 1,000 of these at a month at about $2.5 to $3 million
a piece. Yeah, that's a lot of moolah.
Even in 1960. In the 1960s.
Yeah, yeah. So this ended up being the basis for IBM's, most of IBM's computer businesses moving forward. So, yeah, like we said, big gamble, big payoff. Do you have anything pre-1968? That's the next thing I have.
Pre-1968.
Between 64 and 68.
I would like to point out that they are working with lasers.
Lasers.
At this point, they're using lasers to carry information.
Yes.
As a matter of fact.
They were also looking into storage media using lasers. So this is a precursor to compact discs, laser discs, DVDs, that kind of thing.
They're still working with the Gemini flights. They actually have onboard computers, as it is joked very often. A Commodore 64 was more powerful than these machines.
Yeah.
But at the time, when you think about it, they were going out into space and coming back safely with these devices. So they, you know, they're pretty sophisticated.
Yeah, and really when you get down to it, they were able to crunch the numbers, which is what the computers had to do, right? They didn't have to play Hunt the Wumpus, as awesome as that game was. I keep bringing it up because it's the first computer game I can remember playing ever. It's the first one I remember having is Hunt the Wumpus.
Oh, okay.
A terrible game, by the way. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, not really.
I'll tell you about it after the show.
In 1967, IBM had an exhibit at Canada's Expo 67.
Mm-hmm.
They were also working on the first monolithic integrated germanium circuits.
Is that what was in the beginning of 2001, the thing that fell to Earth and all the apes were dancing around it?
No. That is a monolith.
Oh, okay.
But, yes, you remember we talked about germanium before the podcast when we started talking about semiconductors.
Oh, wait. I was thinking of flowers.
Okay. So, yes, and they also had a trillion-bit photo-digital storage system for the Atomic Energy Commission.
Yep.
It's funny because the information on IBM.com, they have a very, very, very comprehensive timeline with all kinds of stuff. But it's funny because if you look at these documents, and I encourage you to do so, I mean, they're free. Download them at your leisure.
Yeah.
But they break it down into – you know, Jonathan and I are kind of concentrating on the stuff that everyone – I mean, like the stuff that the public would sort of be aware of.
Yes.
But they were making contributions to business in general,
yep.
their business practices, business culture. They were also doing science
yes.
in the background.
Yes.
Look at me still talking when there's science to be done.
The cake is a lie.
So but yeah, they so they're working on all this stuff in particular. So I kind of wanted to note a few of those
sure,
things.
Sure, sure.
Like the Braille typewriter that's coming up in 1968.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, 1968 was a neat year. They started working on the Apollo program. So
yes.
they started to produce computers for the Apollo program. In fact, IBM's very proud to say that the IBM computers at the control center were part of the reason why we were able to get our astronauts back home safely during the Apollo 13 near disaster.
Yes, they could specifically point that out.
Right, yes, that it was IBM systems that helped the engineers back at ground control to get the astronauts back to Earth safely. That's a pretty big deal. They also, in 1968, that's specifically when they started to develop a laser optical memory system.
Yes.
We can start jumping forward a little bit because, like you said, the developments are coming fast and furious at this point. And to cover all of them, we would need an entire afternoon, and we just don't have that time.
And we haven't even been touching on all the scientists who've been awarded the National Technology Prize and
right.
all sorts of other medals and recognitions for the stuff that they've
or
done.
Or we haven't talked about Endicott. We haven't talked about how IBM was investing in scientific knowledge and advancements through their own IBM campuses. I mean, it wasn't just a place to go and work. It was a place to go learn and pioneer. Like, you know, think that motto that came from Thomas Watson Sr., think really did become the central foundation for what IBM was all about.
Yeah, it's
and
about
it
knowledge
still
workers.
Is, really.
Yep.
So 1970, IBM announces the System Stroke 370, which was the successor to the 360.
This is a small snicker moment because, of course, the System Stroke 360 was supposed to be a comprehensive package. So
yeah.
you have your 360 degrees.
Yes.
So I guess now you have 10 more degrees.
Right. Well, you know.
I'm just saying.
Just in case it gets cold. And then there's they also introduced in 1970 the first IBM copier, which became a bigger business for them further down the road.
The first IBM copier?
Yeah.
The first IBM copier.
They're supposed to get less strong as you go on. The first IBM copier.
Well, it's better than the mimeograph machine. That's true.
So in 1971, that's when those Braille printers really started hitting the market.
Yep.
They started to experiment with speech recognition technology in 71. Again, decades before we started seeing this in applications that we would recognize, right? They were working on it in 71. 1973, I'm jumping much further ahead because we're already.
Did you mention the Selectric 2?
Well, no, because we talked about the Selectric enough, I thought.
Okay.
And we're running out of time.
I'm
so,
just teasing.
73, they introduced the IBM diskette, which was a new storage medium that became very important.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Loved those diskettes. I'm not even joking. There's something about being able to physically see how much data you have because you're looking at the disks that is really satisfying to me. You know, when you look at a hard drive, you know how much it can store, but that doesn't, you know, it doesn't give you a visual cue of, wow, I got a lot of stuff.
Our middle school and junior high school student listeners, and we have quite a few of them, are going to laugh because they all have pocket flash drives with
Yeah, that can hold
800 times.
Right, they can hold the entire library I had on diskette on one thumb drive. Yeah,
I was joking. Don't write me in to tell me I was wrong. It was just a saying.
1976, IBM computers are used on the Space Shuttle Enterprise.
I remember that
the prototype of the Space Shuttle program, Enterprise, which was used to test the model. It was not not meant to actually take astronauts into space. But yeah, they used the computers aboard that. And jumping all the way up to 1980, we're just going to end this episode on 1980 because in 1981, we enter a new era in IBM history. So 1980, the gross income for IBM at this point, keeping in mind when it started, 4 million gross income, 1 million earnings, 26.21 billion with a B dollars. The earnings, 3.39 billion. 341,279 employees. So more than a quarter of a million employees at this point. And their products at this time included ultra-fast processors for business computer systems. They did word processors. They still had the typewriters. They were doing data storage media. They had analytical instruments for scientific research development applications. All of this is going on in 1980. And in 1981, they really strike a new they head into a new market.
Before we move on to 81 for our next podcast, I wanted to add a science thing that they did.
Please do.
In 1980, according to the company, some of the researchers were able to start using computers to transcribe human speech. Now we're talking rudimentary, 1,000-word vocabulary here. So it's not like Watson.
Yeah.
But it was able to read and convert speech to print with about 91% accuracy. So
pretty
see, they've
awesome.
Been walking. They've been working on Watson for quite some time now.
Yeah, yeah, that was a long tail game right there.
Yes, but of course, it paid off in the end.
So, yeah, by several thousand dollars, as I recall, because it won the whole championship, right?
Yep.
I'm sure that helped offset the billions of dollars of research and development.
Yes, but they do expect that it will have applications. And if you wondered where Watson's name came from, if you didn't listen to the podcast, the machine that we're talking about that won Jeopardy, beat two human opponents at the game show Jeopardy, it came from the company's
founder-ish. Yeah, the guy who instilled in the company all of the philosophies that have guided it since then.
And really built it into a single company from the three composite companies, the original trust.
So Thomas J. Watson Sr.
Yes. So, anyway.
All right. Well, we are going to wrap this part up. We have one more part to come about the personal computer era of IBM's history. It played a very important role in that whole market. And then we're going to get away from IBM after that. For those of you who are thinking that three podcasts about a company is too much, well, IBM really is instrumental in so many areas of tech. It was hard to be able to shrink it into fewer than three. In fact, we probably could do four or five, but we're not. The third will be our final one, at least for the time being.
Ooh, I forgot one small thing.
Please.
1979.
Yeah.
UPC codes.
So anyway, if you guys want to hear more information about a particular favorite company.
Wait, there's another one. They introduced RISC architecture in 1980.
Please, for the love of all that is good, send us a message on Twitter or Facebook. Our handle there is TechStuff, HSW, or you can shoot us an email. That address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again more about IBM really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.